Welcome to Class 3 in this series of an overview of Britain since the Romans. And I left you last week in the middle of a civil war. Now, civil wars, fortunately, don't happen very often, because they are particularly traumatic. For example, it's almost impossible to be neutral in a civil war. When one of the armies approaches your town, you have to be in favour of them or against them. Yeah. Whereas in other kinds of wars, you go, I don't care very much. Yeah. And so that's absolutely huge. And also, although this is a long time ago, it's nevertheless modern society, in the sense that they have guns, and the number of people killed in the civil war was very large. Yeah. So the reason for the civil war is fundamentally this conflict between the monarchy, which is happy to continue with the old way, the more power the king has, the better, and this fits with the old way of very rigid, immobile hierarchy and traditional rights and duties. So instead of paying tax, you have the right to use this land for your sheep as long as you repair the bridge, which is kind of cute. But not good for the new commercial classes, who want clear rules so that they can invest and get moving forward the modern society, which will become capitalism. Although there are many things to say about capitalism that people don't like, nevertheless, when capitalism arrives in Britain, there will be no more famines. Whereas in the other countries which don't yet have capitalism, there will continue to be famines for a couple of hundred years. Excuse me. Mask effect here. So the civil war then between, on the one hand, the king representing this traditional world, and the parliament representing the modern world. And the most important thing here is not to think that the parliament represented democracy. The parliament did not represent democracy. Only very rich people could vote. As we will see during the civil war, in fact, the most democratic force will be the army, the new model army, which is fighting for Parliament, or at least fighting against the old society. And they will actually become a new kind of army, and at some point they will be electing their own officers. In a rather strange manner, today, if we hear in some countries there's a conflict between the Parliament and the army, democracy is on the side of the Parliament. Not in this case. In this case, it's exactly the opposite. And the reason you have this progressive army is because the elites who want to get rid of the king, or at least who want to radically reduce the power of the king, because there will still be lots of proposals for compromise with the king. Even during the civil war, a section of the elite, they want to compromise with the king, perhaps get a new king, but they're not Republicans. As the conflict goes on, then the new model army will in some ways become a political party. That is to say, it will be the place of debates about what kind of society we want. It will be a radical democratic force. And as I mentioned, some sections, or some what we used to call at the time sects, that is minority religions, will put forward a sort of old-fashioned early communist view of the world, where the land belongs to everybody. Now, of course, when you say, the land belongs to everybody, the king hates you and the parliament hate you too, because the parliament represents the elite of the time. And indeed, here you have a picture which shows the map of the support of the king and the parliament. And you can see at the red, this is year by year, 1642, 1643, 1644, 1645. The royalists are in red. And as you can see, Parliament wins. You're supposed to know this. Yeah, the Parliament wins. Okay, right. And you can see where the support is. Parliament has its support in London, the huge commercial port where big money is already being made from the spice trade. This time, spices like pepper and nutmeg were extremely expensive. In the docks in London, the workers were not allowed to have any pockets. Because if they took home a pocket full of nutmeg, le noix de muscade, they were very rich. It's another world. So that's here. London, of the powerful commercial ports, also up here. And the king, Oxford, the rural areas, the traditional society with the same time. Here are the main battles, which I'm not going to tell you about because all the history books and Wikipedia will tell you which battles happened. But I want to try and tell you why they happened, why they won. Cromwell became slowly the leader of the parliamentary army. And the reason he became the leader is because he had some new ideas. The old traditional army, the royalist army, so they were trying to build a new army to go against the king. But the old traditional idea was, oh well, who should we have as the leader of this regiment? You're a duke, you're not a... Well, they must have the duke, aristocrats lead. So there was no idea in the old army, they didn't base on, well, is he any good at organising military battles? And so Oliver Cromwell represented the new world. Well, let's first of all see, it doesn't matter if he's a duke or not, the people who are actually competent at military. This is what they came to call the new model army. The new model army, this is Cromwell's army. But to mobilise lots and lots of people to fight against the king, Parliament and Cromwell were obliged to go a little further. They were obliged to say, "No, oh, will you fight for Parliament? Well, yeah, maybe. How much is it paid? Yeah. Will you fight for a new society where all people are respected?" And so it was very much a political army, and that's how they got things going. And that meant that they had to allow for a lot of discussions and debates and minority groups who gave their own ideas. And one of them is the levellers. I mentioned the diggers before. Now, the diggers were very radical, but very small. And they actually said, let's just go and take the land. The levellers were much more influential, much bigger, and they were called levellers by their enemies. Ah, vous voulez que tout le monde soit au même niveau, vous, n'est-ce pas? Bon Dieu. They said, well, actually, en fait, finalement, oui, peut-être pas une mauvaise idée. And we, on dit en français, les niveleurs. And so you hear, this is a publication, a manifestation from Lieutenant Colonel John Lilburn, etc. Mr. Richard Overton, now prisoners in the Tower of London, oh dear, styled levellers, intended for the full vindication from the many aspersions, so it's a defence of the leveller leaders from a political point of view. Slowly the king was losing, and eventually the king was captured. And then they had some, what do we do? We've got the captured king, that's good. We don't really want to have a country without a king. I mean, where are the other countries without kings? Well, I can't see any. Can you see any? No. The general situation, of course, the French Revolution had not yet happened. And so a big debate, what do we do? Do we tell this king, you can be king again, provided 1, 2, 3, with this list of conditions? Do we find a new king? It's complicated finding a new king because the whole idea of the king is it's supposed to be hereditary. So if you go and say, oh, anybody want to be king? Then you're breaking the principle of monarchy in a way. You're not supposed to do it like that. Or finally, should we just get rid of the king? And eventually the debates went on. These were also debates about what kind of society we want. This is the reason why we sometimes call the Civil War the English Revolution. And one well-known revolutionary said, the revolution is the festival of the oppressed. Suddenly everything seems possible. There's a whole load of pamphlets by women saying, hey, women are not well treated, let's do this all differently at the time. And indeed, one of my colleagues, which one is it? One of my colleagues is just publishing a book based on one of the women leaders of the time and her diaries. It's very exciting stuff. I'm not an expert of this. So these debates went on, and in fact, a lot of them were more radical than Cromwell. They had radical ideas like the levellers, but Cromwell was under pressure, and so Cromwell said, oh, well, okay, let's have a debate, yeah, between the leaders of the army and some of these radical groups. Now, today, if you're in the army, and you go and see the general and say, celui qui nous réveille le matin, mais c'est beaucoup trop tôt. No, c'est pas ça. If you go and see the general, and you say, hey, I want to have a debate, the generals and radical communists in the army, let's have a debate. Well, the general will not say yes. You don't do this in armies. But at the time, Cromwell was under such pressure that they organised the Putney debates. And these Putney debates were about very, very. And what's wonderful about them from the point of view of a historian is that we have the documents, we have the text of the debate, and all the fabulous ideas, some of them a bit crazy and some of them wonderful, about what kind of society we had. Cromwell managed to, unsurprisingly, Cromwell managed to marginalise the most radical people and establish then Parliament and also move forward to the execution of the king. So they executed the king, and this was, you know, that we talk in the American Revolution about the shot that echoed around the world. This was the axe stroke which echoed around the world. People had not been in the habit of executing their kings. Yeah, that's the French got into the habit later. But this was a very, very big deal. And so they established the English Republic. Now this is fascinating. Even the terminology is very interesting for this. For 11 years there was no king. And if you go to the Tower of London, in London, there's a wonderful corridor with a picture of every king and queen since God knows when, since 1066 at least. And then they arrive at this point, 1649, between 1649 and 1660. And you're walking along the corridor, you know, each king one by one, and then you get to this moment. What do they do? They have a number of choices. So this is a modern museum. They could have a picture of Cromwell, who was not king, but he was leader. In fact, what they do is nothing. He just moves straight on to the next king. There's nothing that this is today. Yeah? And this is the conservative historians have always talked about 1649 to 1660 as the interregnum. Yeah? Entre deux rois. Ce qui n'est pas faux, mais n'est pas très profond comme explication de la situation. The people at the time, Cromwell at the time, spoke of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth. Now, in fact, Commonwealth and Republic are in some ways similar words. Res publica, la chose publique. Commonwealth, la richesse commune. Yeah, we're not very, very far. That was the word they used at the time. But today, you know, people do talk about the English Republic. Although, if you read a historian who says the English Republic, then they're on the left. And if it says the interregnum, they are conservatives. Yeah, because, you know, us historians, we like to fight. Spoiler, I'm more on the left. Okay, not a big spoiler. Okay, so two factors turned the war. One was the intervention of the mass of the people really were turning against Charles. And secondly, the Houses of Parliament decided to unite the army under Cromwell's command. And Cromwell's army. This is not a real photograph, because at the time they didn't have colour photographs. Yeah. Okay. So this is a reenactment. You know who people like to spend their weekends. You can tell it's a reenactment because they have good teeth, apart from the photograph element. So the roundheads. These are what we call the roundheads. The soldiers, and a lot of these were what they called at the time middling men. Middling men. That is not aristocrats. The middle class, if you like. And Cromwell said, you must get men of spirit that is likely to go on. Such people were likely to be middling folk or even common men of poor and mean parentage. So Cromwell's genius, a little bit like Robespierre, is that he realised that the only way to win was to organise people who normally the elite wasn't interested in. And so that's how it did. The success... Of the success of the New Model Army turned the tide, and the Battle of Naseby in 1645 saw the decisive defeat of the King. Parliament carried on and also the Cromwell was the undisputed leader. Parliament carried on a few more reforms. A couple of archbishops were executed. The bishops were abolished. No bishops. This is a Protestant idea, really. No, less hierarchy. But the had he had some problems with the radicals in the army, because they said, well, you know, we've won the civil war now, you can go home. And the New Model Army said, no, we don't want to go home, we want to help organise a new society. Remember you talked about the new society, Cromwell? I can't remember saying anything about new society, did I? Yeah, I'm dramatising a little bit. So England was now a republic, the Commonwealth, the monarchy was abolished. So this is two different things. First of all, you execute the king, but abolishing the monarchy is another step. It means that that nobody else can declare themselves king. The House of Lords was abolished, and there was a thorough demolition of feudal relations. Here is one scholar. Cromwell's task consisted of inflicting as shattering a blow as possible upon the absolutist monarchy, the court nobility, and the semi-Catholic church, which had been adjusted to the needs of the monarchy and nobility. So Cromwell's idea was to put at the top of society the new commercial classes, because this was going to make society more modern, and you know, it did. And although, you know, modern sounds a very neutral word, when you realise that it means that 100 years later there was no longer any famines in Britain, modern can sound pretty good. So, 1649 to 1660, the head of state is Oliver Cromwell, and then his son Richard Cromwell. And I already mentioned that there was the different, you can choose your names, but they're not neutral. The English Republic, the Commonwealth, or the Interregnum, whichever you prefer. The most important thing is not which one you prefer, it's that to understand where each one comes from. So 1649, Charles executed. Now, of course, the difficulty with this is that the traditional society, it had its rules. The king had his place, the aristocrats had its place, and everybody else had their place. So if you're going to replace it by something new, then you have to make up rules. And indeed, this period, we have several constitutional documents. Now, as you probably know, the United Kingdom is a rather strange country. It's one of the very few countries in the world which does not have a written constitution. We don't have constitutional courts, we don't have a constitution. But during this time, there were written constitutions, and two of them were the instrument of government. Faute de frappe, là, il n'y a pas de eux, bien sûr. Finally, the humble petition and advice. Those were two of the constitutional documents which were produced. The fact that we had more than one constitution in just a few years showed that, in fact, it was very difficult for them to stabilise a new system. And eventually they will not succeed in stabilising a new political system. And that is the reason the change. So they try different things. The instrument of government is one constitutional structure, and then they move on to the rule of the major generals with military leaders in each region. And finally, they have another idea, and Cromwell will become Lord Protector for life. Originally, he was Lord Protector for a while, and then he becomes Lord Protector for life. This is important because they're stabilising new society as well, and indeed they will pass the Navigation Acts of 1650 and 1651. This will make the commercial classes very happy, and it will set off a process of economic expansion, which means that they will overtake in the competition their main competitor. Who is their main competitor? Anybody want to guess which country is the main competitor at this time? No, not France. France is the old absolutist monarchy, very, very slow. It is the Netherlands, Les Pays-Bas. The Netherlands are the giants of commerce at this time. So Cromwell will be trying to negotiate with some of the big landowners, with the commercial classes, and try to find a new system. But he will be each time rather unhappy with the results, and will frequently be dissolving the parliaments which he calls. when Cromwell dies in 1659, he is replaced by his son, who has a rather unfortunate situation because he becomes head of state, but he never wanted the job. And indeed, when he will no longer be head of state, just 1 year later, and he will eventually just be an ordinary citizen in a village somewhere. And you know, people talk to him, oh, you know, the old man over there, he used to be head of state, you know. He never got, he was lucky he didn't get executed and stuff. So what happened then? 1660, the Restoration. That is to say, after all this civil war and executing the king and the English Republic, and then we just said, oh, well, let's have kings again. That sounds very bizarre. I mean, it sounds like we just go back to this, the interregnum idea. Is oh, well, we'll just continue as before. In fact, they really did not continue as before, because, as one scholar said, what has been written with the sword cannot be wiped away with a pen. The balance of forces was completely different, and the basic spoiler, the new king was allowed to become king, provided that he recognised that Parliament was boss, and not the king. Yeah, so So the Restoration in 16, but basically what happened is that there's a crisis going on, and they asked the son of the executed king to come back and be king. He was probably in France, I guess. And so, from the point of view, point of view of the form was respected. That is to say, that the Restoration showed that Charles II, the son of Charles I, had been king since the day his father was executed. Yeah, so on paper, the English Republic had never existed. However, no one imagined that absolutism could come back. Everybody understood that Parliament was boss now. The process of restoration was very expensive. All the debts of Charles I and Charles II were respected. The king relinquished a whole series of feudal dues, and just a few years later, they voted to say that the king will receive a salary from Parliament. Okay, so a completely different situation. We get the king back, but previously, the king, when he wanted money, he said, oh, well, I'll invent a new tax. But the new situation, when you're receiving a salary from somebody, obviously they're your boss. And so that was the situation. Here you have the statue of Cromwell in front of the Houses of Parliament. So here you have something very interesting. Yes, so the Oliver Cromwell, who organised the execution of the king and the establishment of the English Republic, later, 100 years later, gets a statue in front of the Houses of Parliament as a great defender of rights, and not as a horrible radical. So this is the way that, you know, once they are safely dead, radicals can often be recuperated. Look at Nelson Mandela. The Conservative Party leadership in England went to Nelson Mandela's funeral. But when he was in jail, they had posters, "Hang Nelson Mandela," at the time. So, you know, if you're dead, you're safe. And so that tends to be the thing that happens. Oliver. Because the king really wanted to come back, of course, you know, he didn't know how to do any other job. Because the king really wanted to come back, he signed a special declaration, which was an amnesty. If you joined the parliamentary army to fight the king, you will not be punished. This was essential, because he wasn't going to get his job back any other way. Now, some of the people from the king's army who had been leaders in the king's army were very angry at this, and they wanted revenge. And they looked at the 60 people who had signed the king must die in the parliament, 11 years earlier. Yeah, and 9 of them were executed, whereas Cromwell, the bodies of Cromwell and 2 more people who were dead, they dug up their bodies and cut them in 4 and put them on the streets in front of the parliament. Yeah, just for fun. Of course, the reason for this is to have, you know, don't do it again. Yeah, that's the idea. Don't do it again. And finally, the new king accepted a change that there would be no standing army, no permanent army. The king could not have a permanent army. Obviously, this is something that would stop him from regaining absolute power. Yeah, the name of the declaration where he said, "You will not be punished if you fought against my father in the civil war," was the Declaration of Breda. I'm not very good with names and dates. Pity, I should say. Pity. Bad news for a historian. What can you do? That's about it there. So Charles II came along and did what he could. But he really was tempted by bringing back more power for the king. It was difficult because he didn't have a standing army, but that was his idea. And in particular, he was shown to be too sympathetic to Catholics. Now here is where the religious question comes back and joins the political question. I'm sure you remember that the idea of Catholics, especially the elite in Britain, was that they are probably in sympathy with France and Spain and absolute monarchy. And so the Catholics were considered to be political enemies, although there was also a religious difference. And so Charles II was being more generous to Catholics, and this rather frightened the elites. And they, when he died, and it looked like his brother, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's his brother, well, his brother came to the throne, his brother was much worse and even more in favour of Catholics and absolutism, and so they had a new idea among the leaders of the parliamentary elite, and they wrote to another king abroad, William of Orange, and they said, "Oh, would you like to come and be our king?" And so William invaded with an army, but there was almost no resistance. Yeah, James II, I'm pretty sure, organized an army and marched to meet William, but there was his soldiers were just paid mercenaries and they didn't really fight. Also, James had a bad day. If you think you're having a bad day, James had a really bad day. When the army of William was on the way, James's sister abandoned him and joined the other army. I hate it when sisters do that. You know, it's just awful. And so, basically, there was enough of a consensus among the elites in England that did not want any chance of a return to absolutism and a return to the influence of Catholicism that William and his wife Mary fairly easily became, in 1688, the new monarchs. This episode, 1688, is known as the Glorious Revolution, and as one well-known writer said, it was neither glorious nor a revolution, because in fact, you know, there was no real resistance and there was nothing really glorious about it. However, it was the last moment, the last time when it was still possible to imagine a Catholic king. And so the Glorious Revolution has become a great symbol, especially in Northern Ireland, of Protestant history. So the moment when we got rid of the Catholics from the monarchy for good, partly because they tended to like absolutism, and also because they didn't, you know, they believed superstition. It's very interesting though. In religion, very often we think, my religion is religion, your religion is superstition. It's a matter of a point of view. So that was the Glorious Revolution in 1688, and that's the end of that bit of a story. But I have more. But perhaps a moment if you have questions. I'm going to stop there as well because.